Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The War Room, which is, of course, our interview series with a whole bunch of the wonderful Trek alumni. I am your host, Sean Ferrick, and joining me is author, actor, editor, archivist, consultant, amazing shirt wearer.
This is my cue to get my Portal 47 badge out. There, wow. Okay.
I like this.
And of course, Mr. 47. That's how well we rehearse this thing. Dr. Trek himself, it's Larry Nemechek. How are you getting on, Larry?
I am doing just fine, Sean. It's amazing to see you and say congratulations on the way you built the channel up. And thanks for having us on. This is awesome.
Thank you so much. I mean, this is the wonderful, lovely thing about how ridiculous life is. You're thanking me. I'm just like, what? I'm just delighted that you've agreed to talk to me, that I managed to get through so many levels of your security.
Well, you know, look, speaking of getting through levels. Okay, so I just checked the date. So I can't believe it's been 10 years. 10 years ago, my wife used to work for a huge travel agency. We had a free bus tour around Ireland for 5 days. We had to get ourselves there, but then we had that. Okay, fine. So on the way, I said, I'll look for Star Trek fans in Ireland. In 2012, I'm looking online. I can't find anyone. I found one guy who did a very, very, very early, it was radical, video podcast on camera in 2012. Darren Maloney, I want to say. Anyway, I was trying to find, because we're in and out of Dublin and then across, you know, all the standard tourist stops in and out. And that was the only, I found a mainstream LitCon and I wrote to them and they're like, well, we're in October, so we can't, you know, I'm like, okay, no partying, no meetup. Okay, fine. Fans. Okay. Anyway. And then within 3 years, boom, here's this explosion of, I was like, where were you guys 3 years ago, 4 years ago? Where? Okay. It would have been a treat to come party and stay along the way. But anyway, but here we are now.
Here we are now.
Through the magic.
To the magic of technology. In fact, yeah, it's one of the many, many wonderful things to come out of the last 2 years. I'm going to stick with the word that was in my head. The smaller ring of the world, thanks to this wonderful Zoom technology.
I like that. Yes. Yeah. Now, some of us were Zooming and even free conference call videoing when we started Portal 47 in 2015 and used to have to explain what that was. And then, oh gosh, thank you, pandemic. Now at least I don't have to explain. And every grandmother has a nice webcam now, whereas they didn't in 2015 and 2016. So there's silver lining for the pandemic. I don't know.
There absolutely is. And actually, do you know what? Because obviously everyone's experience was different with the apocalypse. But one lovely thing that has come out of the last years is the, I think, almost solidifying of the Trek community online. It's been a bit wonderful. There's been so many people who seemed the kind of people who would be like me, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, but like, kind of down around, you know, the back of the library going, hey, you like Trek? Yeah, I like Trek too. Yeah. Okay. Do you want to watch an episode? Okay, cool. Whereas now more and more people are kind of out and proud to be like, you know, kind of we're in front of the library now.
Are you talking about you're kind of making a thing there about the Twitterverse and Facebook and Instagram's too pretty for that, even though it's Facebook. I mean, are you talking about the online world? Because that's a microcosm of, you know, what happened in the 70s, 80s, and then, you know, in circles coming out of the closet. And then it's almost like coming out of the virtual closet, I guess is what you're saying.
That's actually, I love that turn of phrase. I will steal that. That's a great turn of phrase. It's like, so if I may be so bold, so I, you know, kind of doing my due diligence about you, I think you're a Star Trek fan.
It got out. Okay. Yeah, that's right. We kind of started talking more about it a few years ago. Okay. Yeah.
For the purposes of people who are not watching.
We're not doing sport, as you say in Europe. Sport, not sports, but
no,
sport.
No, no, no.
There's only sport. One, and it has many forms. So it's sport.
And it is all played at the same time on the same pitch, and it's pure chaos, but it's just called sport.
It's on one pitch, like A flat, and then it's all the same. Yeah, no, anyone knows me knows I have my football Sooners. Who won the women's softball title this year in college softball. So also so cool now. Anyway.
I am delighted. I am very, very happy that there is such a thing as a softball, I believe you refer to it as. No, I do actually know what that is.
It's at the risk of being genderist, it's can be played either way, but primarily in especially collegiate sports here, it's the women's baseball.
Gotcha.
A softball. Softball is, and it's basically, I should say, it's instead of overhand like baseball is, it's underhand pitch.
Okay.
But it's the same basic rules. You know, you have batters that run bases and all of that. So
that is great. It actually sounds like something, because I tried baseball once in my life. This is all about Star Trek. No, I tried baseball once in my life.
I was going to say. Yeah. Yes. Before we get to the Star Trek part.
Yeah. It's hard. That ball's really small.
And it doesn't matter whether you are big or little or fast or slow. It helps if you're fast. But no, you've got to have, it's the eye-hand coordination. It's like everybody in the team has to be a quarterback and receiver in football or something. Anyway.
I know those words.
Then there's the good old part of fandom that would just talk about sports ball and move on. Yes. Okay.
In the spirit of fandom, I'm sure there's a lot of people going like, you know, this Sean guy's a bit up himself. I want to hear from Larry. So first of all, like really, really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today. Like, thank you so much.
Well, I know it was good to meet because it's been interesting because I remember 10 years ago when Chris Jones first came. I mean, podcasting was a new thing, audio podcasting. And Chris Jones, who founded Trek FM, kind of pioneering a lot of this. After about 5 or 10 times being on his show, he's like, you know, our most downloaded shows are the ones that you're a guest on. And I'm like, oh, well, maybe that should tell me something. Like, should I do this? And I'm like, no, there's so many people doing a podcast. I want to wait till I can do something that's a little different, or we're not just one or two more people talking. We're got something unique to add. And I thought, you know, someday when cameras are a thing and we have video podcasts, I'll do that. And lo and behold, the revolution came without me while I was looking otherwise. But that first wave wound up being so toxic, you know, and then I got on and I have no time to edit. And so my whole thing was like, what can I do quick and dirty? And people in my entrepreneur circles were saying, oh, just go live on Periscope or on Facebook Live. And so that's where Trek Tuesdays Live came from, Trekland Tuesdays Live. And it was like, just get on and get live and say something, you know? And so I've been doing that for had the 5-year anniversary from 2015 when it was literally hold up your camera, talk. And when you did live chat questions, scroll on your phone in the beginning. I did a show the first year or two called Who Mocks the Mockers, because it was looking like the toxic tidal wave was going to take over. And that's, you were talking about people coming out of the virtual closet, but that's one thing I've been glad to see after the first 2 or 3 years. It's kind of like sanity. I say clarity, sanity, the big picture in Star Trek every week, but it's like the sanity has taken over, because I was really worried there for a while that the online was just going to drown out everything. And you could have your differences with Discovery or whatever, but my God, people don't go down the wacky hole, which seemed the way the whole world was going. And it feels like there's been kind of this grab it and lurch things back to
I think you're so right. I have to ask. So
thanks to people like you,
you're very kind. What I try and do is just put out a bit of positivity. I mean, we're all fans at the end of the day. Even if you don't like something, you don't have to tell someone they're an idiot for liking it. Or specifically the people who make they seek out the people who make the show to go, here's why you are wrong. It's like, no, just don't watch it. If you don't like it, don't watch it. It's fine. The world is not going to end if you don't watch it.
I mean, it's what we're doing right now is face to face, even though we're both have our name. We don't have a fake name, much less a fake avatar. We're actually really here talking, even though we're virtual. It's like I keep saying, where are all these people when you actually have a live con? Now, I always say that online fandom is not all fandom. Live convention fandom is not all. You can't make the mistake of looking online and thinking that's all fandom. You can't make the mistake of going to a con and thinking that con people are people who have the wherewithal and the knowledge and the money to get themselves there. Especially the bigger the con, if it's Trek Vegas or it's a DST or it's San Diego or some other big Comic-Con, you had to have the wherewithal to get yourself there. So, you know, what I've always called armchair fans are always going to be out there, even when everybody in their armchair supposedly has a mobile device and can get online, they're still some people that just watch the shows. And maybe they buy a book or a comic or they buy an action figure, but that's their, you know, and maybe they get sucked in, you know, God bless them. And maybe that's all they do their whole life. And it, you know, they're out there because, you know, there's way more eyeballs, you know, spinning these meters than there are people that show up at cons and even people who are online. Anyway, I just always try to remember that, and people get all their panties in a wad about what's going on online. And that's very true. That's the tip of the spear in some ways, but it's the tip of a spear of certain spear carriers. And a lot of people are in the army, don't carry spears. Oh, this is getting bizarre. Okay, this is what happens when I do live stuff.
It's funny.
Getting these weird metaphors.
It's a good metaphor. It did get increasingly like, okay, all right, I feel like we're about to declare war against the Klingons here. But I saw where it was going. I did.
Only after the Organians have defanged everybody. Okay.
Yeah, eventually, like, how long ago do you reckon the Organians just left? And they were just like, ah, they still think we're out there.
Well, see, what's tricky is there was an Enterprise plot with Organians, which you think, aha, and then you went, oh, but that was 100 years before Kirk, so it doesn't, okay, so who cares? Yeah. Went back into their cave.
I guess they must have by the time DS9 rolled around.
Yeah. Mm. Well, yeah. I'm the purist that was mad when Wrath of Khan came out. And by the way, at least in Oklahoma, in the South, it's not the Wrath of Khan, it's Wrath of Khan.
Oh,
when
yeah.
I saw Wrath of Khan.
Yeah.
It's like Chaka Khan, only it's Wrath of Khan.
Sorry. I laughed a bit much there. Well, that was true.
It totally is. No, I was the one watching. It was so cool. It was off. You know, it was awesome. It was cool. It was a little bit of that's more like it. But when they were doing when the graphics were scrolling by and you're hearing the voiceover, it's all very quickly and you're sitting in theater and there's no capturable. You know, nobody knows this unless you've got the comic or the novel or, you know, whatever, the photo story. But the fact that he says Gamma Hydra Sector, I was like, oh, cool. My little 1982 Trekoid brain was going, oh, Gamma Hydra, that's so cool, because Gamma Hydra's near the neutral zone. Oh, and they're in the neutral zone. Oh, that's so cool. And it's a Klingon ship. And I'm like, what are Klingons doing in the Romulan neutral zone? And like, oh, okay, well, they must, you know, after a while, I'm like, they were so rogue, they had come over the neutral zone bubble and were, that's why it was such a shock. That's why it's such a shock. You're not looking for Klingons in the Romulan neutral zone. What are they doing there? And then everybody's like, well, it's the Klingon neutral zone. And I'm like, no, there is no Klingon neutral zone. It's that would be, that's how boring is to have the Romulan neutral zone and then the Klingon neutral zone. That's, if you want to be a Franz Joseph Schnabelty person, a tech manual fiend, like a whole generation was, then that's the Organian treaty zone. But even if you don't, like, just don't call it the same thing as the Romulan, you know, thing, but that's what everybody has done since, including all the showrunners. So that's a little thing I kind of go, oh, well, but that, you know, there's a million of those things, but I'm that guy that sat there and said, why is the, okay. And I had my little retcon, my little canon smoothing thing all done. And then everybody had to just go and pound on it and pound. So, okay. Rant over.
Larry, I'm here
see,
for the rant.
See,
I'm
here for comment. The rant. Sean, I do a comet every week and try to be above all this, but I can get back in the weeds as good as anybody. So
good. It's grand. It's cool. It's cool. But like, that's actually funny. It's so funny. I just want to really quickly say, because I watched, it was 1993, 1994 that I kind of started like my, oh, wow. This guy has a problem with Star Trek. Like, he needs help. And that's kind of where that's kind of started for me. And
or
I remember
you.
As okay. in me, yeah. I mean, sorry, both of us. Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's great. We'll help each other out. But going into, like, you know, kind of watching a lot of Next Gen, a lot of DS9, and then going, of course, and kind of catching up a little bit on the movies. And I was like, what the hell is a Klingon neutral zone? I don't know. 100%, I did not know what they were referring to. Because I think Crime of the Century, I think I watched the movies out of order. And so, like, it was a long time. Like, I knew that Robin Curtis was Savick. Long before I knew Kirstie Alley was Savick.
Wow. Okay. No, but you know, see, again, this is after all this, these many years and decades, there are a lot of people that, you know, people all come to Star Trek. I love hearing people say, well, my first Star Trek was Star Trek VI or Star Trek IV or, you know, Ali Matu, my partner for 2 years on Life Support Live, always would talk about how Star Trek IV was his first Star Trek or Star Trek VI. Now I forget. But anyway, one of the later movies. And it's like, you know, those people might as well have been Next Gen fans when it comes to the original series, because it all looks is out of place. If you come to it with a later movie, it all feels out of place because you're like, why do they never let Sulu and Uhura talk? You know,
it's so painfully true. So painfully true.
We're like just being prophets here, going backwards in the, you know, non-linear timeline.
Time is nothing. Time is nothing here. But actually, you have segued us to a question I really wanted to ask you. So obviously, like, you've been a fan forever, and you've been working with Star Trek for so long. So you've probably seen so many waves of so-called new Trek, like when TNG was new Trek, you know, when like Enterprise was new Trek.
When TNG was new and they called it NU Trek, it made sense because New Coke had just been out, and that was a double-edged sword. And that's what it, yeah. All these people that call the bad robot or the secret frontier, secret hideout. Yeah, secret hideout. Yes. I have to go click through. Call that new Trek. I just want to laugh. It's like, guys, at least get like a new silly moniker for it. Don't, you know, and I know that's generational, but every time I go that, I go back to 86 and the people complaining, which I love trotting those out. I've got old Interstat when, you know, pre-email, pre-anything, and the highest level of fandom, not to be elitist, but if you were digging for something beyond the letters column in Starlog or something, you know, the random thing, if you got Interstat, which was, I don't know, 50 or 100 or 200 people on a mailing list, and this little reduced type zine, but it was all these people talking, and 30% now what we would call shippers, they were all women arguing about fan characters, and there was like about 8%, and I don't want to be genderist here, but mainly guys, I think. I was like, can we talk about getting more alien representation in? Can we ever go to the Federation Council? Can we ever go to, you know, there were some of us trying to talk about background and things, and but there were like 8 of us or something. I felt like there were like 8 people in the country that cared about anything that wasn't something about Spock. I'm like, okay, I get it. That's fine. Of course it is. Now, can we move on to stuff nobody's talked about yet? But that's where you were. But I love going back to those in 1986 and seeing how many chunks of people were resenting Next Gen because it was new, because they thought it was denigrating Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. You can't replace them. Like, you can't erase them. And it's canceled. I mean, not, you know, it's like you're throwing out the old, and this is what built you, and how dare you call this new thing Star Trek when it's not. And the whole paradigm of a franchise that's going to have different was a completely new thing, as much as serialized storytelling was a completely new thing now, or the fact that we care about who's taping and watching later versus watching live was a completely new, I mean, you know, and it's like Star Trek's been at the edge of all those over the years. But I love pulling those clips out in the last 3, 4, 5 years and showing people who were like, I'm not watching this new Star Trek, how dare you, you know. And I'm like, and I was saying, really, people? It's Gene doing the show. It's his show. This is what you wanted for 20 years, new Star Trek. They're not wiping, you know, very clearly saying it's 100 or 78 years later. You know, what? And it took a while. And then, of course, there was just the question of wobbly production at the beginning, but it eventually found its legs. But every wave has that, however it gets expressed. And that helps. Now, that's, and as always, not to take away the ability to criticize with legit criticism, like you were saying at the beginning, but because I can and I will. Touch screens and smart holograms, I'm telling you what, that was a tough one. My headcanon was that they figured out in 5 years they caused cancer, and so they had to revert everything back.
But actually, it's funny because I do like there's a joke in season 2, I think it is, a Discovery, where Una makes a point like, you know, oh, you won't be seeing those holograms again on the Enterprise. I'm like, I like that, mm-hmm. You know, because I think everyone was a little bit, and when I say everyone, I mean me, when that first trailer for Discovery came out, and I went, mm-hmm. I kind of had to have a word with myself and go like, now listen, I love the original series. I love Trials and Tribulations. I think it looked fantastic. And I loved Inner Mirror Darkly. But could I do an entire series in the 60s aesthetic today? And I still don't really have an answer for that. But I do. I completely, they had to update the sets. They had to make it look a bit more future, because we have, in real time, we have advanced beyond, you know, feeding that. I saw a fantastic meme the other day, is that I love that on the original Enterprise, they used to feed blocks of cheese to the computer to make it do things. You know,
I was like, well, I thought those were like marshmallows and mangoes or something.
Nice varied diet that they gave to the computer of the Enterprise.
I
love it. And you know, it's we have advanced beyond that, and that's fine. I mean, yes, I love. I'm sitting here for the purpose of people listening. I'm wearing Spock's uniform from the original series. Which
hold up a cuff. Is it really a Spock? Okay, it's a commander. Okay.
I thank you. I was like,
people want to say all blue. No, that's a 2260s science outfit you're in uniform there, tunic.
And
regular duty tunic you're in, Sean.
Now, Larry, I know, Larry, that you've been following me for years at this point. So you know that I'm obsessed with uniforms. That is my thing. Uniforms once lockdown started and I discovered that eBay is a thing and apparently I don't like having money, I started collecting uniforms. And some of these ones are quite hard to find. Like, I can't find McCoy's.
Oh, well, so that you have a mom that built you that, because that was what I wanted at first, obviously. And I had to have the braid is harder because you have to do the spot braids and not just sew on a deal. So, no, I had to make sure that I was not, people would say, oh, you've got a Spock. I said, no. And you hold up the wrist. This is a McCoy. It's a lieutenant commander. Because he brings everybody else down to earth. So you're a uniform guy. Are you a uniform Delta 2260s guy, or are you a every ship has its own patch guy?
Oh, every ship has its own patch. Every ship has its own patch. Yeah, no, I love, like, this is very much like, this is an Enterprise top. I love it, and I love that they have, at least in a way, they've brought that back in Strange New Worlds, but the Colony has its own, and I just like, I appreciate that. Now the Farragut didn't, and we will be having words about that, but that's all right. alternate history didn't happen. That's fine. In fact, we just spoke to Matthew McFadyen, who was the Romulan commander in that episode. We had a lot of fun talking about that. And just you beat Kirk.
So was he wearing a Delta?
Kirk was wearing a Delta. The Romulan commander was wearing a frown.
That was just a trick. Just a trick question to make sure you are indeed the real Sean Ferry.
I realized halfway through answering, it's like, I took it seriously, didn't I? Oh, I failed. I failed you all.
No. There are no
over as host on the War Room from this point on.
There are no bad choices. There are no wrong answers.
The Dominion should have won the war.
Yeah, I could sit behind your card table at the park and say, yeah, convince me I'm wrong.
This is all right. So I have what is potentially a silly question, but like, what is Larry Nemechek's introduction to Star Trek? What is the day remember?
Well, I can't give you a day. I can give you a year, basically. But no, I've told this story a few times that I'll tell your audience. No, I when Star Trek was on live, and yes, I was a little kid, but my older brother ran the TV, and I do remember Lost in Space being on, and I do remember playing Robot and Will Robinson at recess at the playground. But I was vaguely aware of there was some space show with a guy with ears, but we never saw it, never watched it. I didn't control the TV. And ninth grade, though, I'll tell you the whole story. I'm walking by. So we had a first year science teacher right out of college. We were her first class. She was all gung-ho and excited, and she was trying to improve the science program for freshmen for ninth grade, ninth year nine, whatever you all say.
There's so many different ones. How old are you at this point?
So I would be 15.
15. Grant, that's
14, yeah. 15 or 15, 16. Okay.
So for the Irish listeners, that's junior cert.
Okay.
That's great. Yeah.
So I'm walking by here, like late in class, we're done. Basically we're fooling around the last 5-10 minutes. And I walk by her desk and two of her good students, whatever. There were a lot of them in the class, so it wasn't like anybody was out. I was one of them. Okay. So I'm walking by, and it was a couple of girls, just to know. And I walk by, and I see they've all got blue dots on their heads. And I walk by, and at that time, Ajax cleanser was the blue dot cleanser was their thing, and they had blue dots. And I walk by, and I said, what are you all doing? And they're like, ha, ha, ha. I'm like, what is this that? Are you doing blue dot cleanser commercials for Ajax or something? And my ninth grade science teacher, then Mrs. Pollard, said, no, Larry, we're Hawkins. And I said, what? And she said, we're Hawkins. And I said, what? And then the line that will haunt me my entire life, she said, oh, Larry, don't tell me you don't know about Star Trek. And I was like, oh, it's that space show with the guy with the ears. And she goes like, you go home right today. And we were in rerun generation by then. She goes, you go home today and watch Star Trek. And it was on after school on Channel 5 in Oklahoma City at 4 o'clock, 4 to 5. She's like, you go home today and watch Star Trek. And you tell me what you think in a few, you know. And I'm like, okay. And I get home and some convoluted logic. That was when it was still on Saturday morning NBC. The animateds were still on live. And I'm like, and I knew that, see, because you're living in the world and you see, you know, culture fly by you. What culture? Trek culture. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to watch it as a cartoon. And if I like it as a cartoon, then I'll waste my time on the live action. For some reason, that logic made sense. I don't know why today, but I actually, so in this whole telling, I think I have to go back and say, I actually saw animated Star Trek first. And then after a day, I was like, okay, fine. I'll watch it after. Well, within, you know, if you do the math, there's 80 shows, 79 shows. That's basically, and there's 4 weeks of weekdays. If a week is 5 weekdays, that's 20 in a month. Mm. Mm-hmm. So you've got 4 months of reruns before they cycle through on your local station, right? So you go through 4 months, you've seen them all. And then at the second month, you realize they're starting over again. Oh, I've seen this one before. I haven't seen that one before. And after a while, and then you're looking in TV Guide and going, oh, that's this and that's that. I mean, when you're totally, you know, stone knives and bearskins. And at some point though, here's the tech manual. Oh, here's the making of Star Trek, like the early books, and you're getting them. And I remember going in and a couple things. One, when I bought one of the David Gerald books, like his World of Star Trek and maybe a photo novel or something. Anyway, I bought 3 books all at once, paperbacks, little paperbacks all at once. And the guy at B. Dalton's at the mall said, ah, yes, yes. Yeah, we try to keep a lot of Star Trek in stock for all of our Trekkies. And I was like, oh, is that what? Oh, okay. Did I cross a line here? Okay. And I didn't resent the term, you know, yet or have any kind of, I just went, oh, okay. But the other story is I remember at Christmas when the tech manual came out and I was like, oh, here, this was so cool. Cause it wasn't just a bunch of words and little paper. It was big and arts and graphics and all the cool stuff. And I said, here, mom, see, this is what my mom who indulged me stamp collecting, model rocketry, all these hobbies and things. Cause we live kind of out of isolated. And I said, here, mom, this is what I put this on my Christmas list. This is what I want. And she's like, I don't know, Larry, $5.95 for something that doesn't really exist. And I just looked at her like, okay. So I put it back. No tech manual in at Christmas under the tree, but spring break by March, I had some money. I spent a week with my older brother at his college town. Was looking around, went down to the little mini mall they had in their mini town, and they had one copy of the tech manual. I bought it with my own money, damn it. I still have the receipt. So I was able to go into school, look at my two buddies, Mike and Cliff, and say, aha, I told you, the patch does match the uniform color. So you want to go back to the early days. That's where it all hit me. And then after that, boom, boom, boom. And like 1 year we were on vacation and I bought the making of Star in Colorado, bought the making of Star Trek and oh, okay, life changed. And then the next summer I found what turned out to be number one Starlog with the full guide, you know, in it. And then nothing. And then a year or two later, I found all the rest of, had a friend that took me in, you're younger than me, took me into my first comic stop. Nostalgia store, bookstore, and there were 2 full color covers with McCoy on the front. One was old original Trek magazine, and one was the giant poster book with McCoy and all the medical props inside. And I was like, holy shit, okay, fine. And then we were kind of off and running after that.
That's I love that. It's almost like kind of it's like a dipping your toes in the water, but it's also that dipping is coming as you have dived from a very high height and there's no coming back up from the water at this point, because I think Trek is a wonderful thing.
And that
Trek
was a country consumes. Swimming wading pool. That was not a nice urban pool that was on everybody's GPS. No, that was you had to go dig out and find. Where the best swimming hole was. Yeah.
Oh, the swimming hole. Sorry. I love that so much. Like, you know, there's the little, like the post that's just been smacked into the ground and it says like, you know, if you drown, you drown. It's one of those things like, like, you know, lifeguard.
No.
You touch bottom. It is gushy. So sorry. Yeah.
Oh yeah. My God. But like that is that's hilarious because like we all have our own obviously stories of how we came to Trek. Now your story is wonderful because you came to Trek and then you know you started.
Yeah, and everybody's story is unique and everybody's story is great and wonderful. It's where they are. It's what time period it is. It's where they are. Who you know. But I had nobody in life leading me by that. I didn't have a dad or a mom or Uncle Fred or cousin Judy or something. You know, or best friend down the street. It was like. Well, okay, I had my ninth grade science teacher, I guess.
Yeah, and we thank her. Thank you very much. Mrs. Pollard, did you say?
It was. Her first name is Rebecca. I've gone blank on her soon remarried name, but married forever name. So, yes. Well, but thank you, Mrs.
We very much thank her. Now, we just hope that she's one of the Holocons from the Prime Universe, not the Mirror Universe. And hopefully she had a much happier life and fate than they did.
I think, yes. I think she's Prime material.
That's all right. That's cool. Definitely, that's cool. Yeah.
Not of that until now, but yeah.
It's just like,
absolutely.
Oh, no. And that was the last time we saw Mrs. Pollard.
She was there the next day, thankfully, but not the next year. She got a better job and moved on.
Well, I'm glad she got a better job. And she did an amazing thing is she introduced you to Star Trek. This, you know, she kind of lit the fuse that leads to many things, really. But also just because just in my little due diligence before we came on, I was reading down through like, you know, kind of, oh, well, Larry, there was like, you know, kind of, oh, that's really a lot of crimes, Larry. But OK, that's fine. Yeah. And then we get down to I didn't realize, sorry, that you had written the episode Prophecy.
Well, now let's be precise. So okay. Janet and I pitched it and then they bought it and it went through, you know, it was delayed. The saga now we have to joke about, no, the longest pitch to delivery was The Cage.
Oh, you know, yeah, 100%. 56 years. I love that. Yeah.
But like 6 years was a long time to, I've seen a couple of people take that and run with it, but it's kind of funny. No, we pitched it before, like they were six shows in filming. The pilot was a month away from airing. We pitched in December 94 because Janet was working there. Everyone knew me from interviewing and Janet was now working temp and then soon to be permanent as assistant script coordinator. So she's there with the writers. And, you know, we knew not only what the show was, but like how it had already evolved 6, 8, 10 shows in.
Hmm.
And we're trying to be on top of those trends and came up with 4 or 5 pitches. And then or like 3 or 4 we worked really hard on. And then I said, OK, you know what? We need 1 or 2 more. Here's a throwaway. They've got a half Klingon in the cast. We should do one where they meet Klingons in the Delta Quadrant. You know. And it's a B'Elanna show and she's caught in the middle and she hates her Klingon side anyway. But now it's, you know, and that of course is the one that Jerry and we pitched to Jerry Taylor. And that of course is the one she latched onto. But we were story, but they took our, it sat for various reasons, which have been told a million times now, but basically it kept getting kicked out. They liked it. They bought it. They paid us money for the story, but it kept getting kicked down the road for various reasons. Oh, we've got too many Alpha Quadrant races now. It doesn't feel very far away. We just split B'Elanna in half. Oh, they just brought Klingons on the DS9. We'll look like we're copycatting. And after 4 or 5 years, the whole premise was that she was single. And by that time she was hooked up with Tom and wasn't available to Dally. So that took that away from it. And the seventh season when everything was in flux and we knew they were working on Enterprise and Brannon had stepped back and Ken Biller was running the show and I went by after hiatus to say hi to everybody in their offices back when you could do that.
Mm.
And he said, oh, Larry, do you still have your notes from that show, that pitch you and Janet did? And I'm like, I'm trying not to scream inside and said, yeah, like it's, you know, he said, we can't find them anywhere in the archive. Like I wanted to say, aren't they right next to the Ark of the Covenant? But but so, yes, I go back and I'm like, don't scream or anything, but they want to see our notes from the show. Well, by then they had to update it because she and Tom were a thing. And the show you see and the show you don't see because they had to cut some scenes at the beginning, which is very sad for time. But that's it. So, yeah. So there's 6 names on it. We're very gratified. They kept us on for ego's sake and also to keep getting a little, you know, $10 piece of the pie every half year or something. But. But that's, yeah, that's the prophecy story. Yeah. I pitched two or three more times on DS9, and you know you're doing really well when they don't buy your pitch, but then they use your idea later, kind of.
I have, so I have actually spoken to two other people who have not, I just said, isn't it funny that? There, just, and that's fine. That's no one's accusing anyone of anything. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just like, these the ideas kick around, and I think sometimes ideas, they get used maybe when somebody should have been paid for it. But,
Well, I had four or five. I had one of the editors on the show who went in, and one of the film editors who on the side would go in and took advantage to go pitch ideas to people who didn't confront me, but I said, oh, I heard you had a story sale. Yeah, blah, blah, sitting in the outer lounge somewhere. And I said, yeah, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, oh, I pitched a story about Klingons in the Delta Quadrant. And you're like, I heard several did. It's like, you know, so that time it came around to us. And no, I pitched the story of whatever. What about Nog's ex-wife or Rom's ex-wife, Nog's mother? And I'll never forget. I could tell I was with Ron Moore, and his face just totally went blank. I said, didn't you ever wonder whatever happened to Rom's ex and Nog's mother? And I swear to God, Ron Moore just went, I just assumed she was dead. And I'm like, well, that's a great creative, way to keep your creative doors open on that one. So the karma is that they mention her because they were going to set it up and be the B story of, I've gone blank on the title, but it's Worf and Dax go on the secret mission, and she's injured, and he should leave her behind, but he doesn't. He goes back and gets her.
I don't consider myself cool for knowing this. That is the episode Change of Heart.
Heart. Yeah. I don't like deal with episodes every day.
No.
But that was supposed to be the B story. They had the whole script written, and Change of Heart expanded so much that they had to totally excise. There's no mention of his ex-wife, Nog's mother, coming to the station. And there's a triangle with her and Lita and Ron, basically. But and for a long time, the actors, the Ferengi Family Hour, Chase and Max and Aaron and Lolita Faggio did that sometimes with Armin, did a con show called the Ferengi Family Hour. And they had the B pages, the B plot pages, and they basically did a reader's theater kind of version of the plot for fans, which was awesome. Anyway, they totally took that. And I know for a fact that they had no plans to do it till I said it. So, but Star Trek has afforded me an awful lot. So it's when you hear so many other people that happens to, you know?
Yeah. I guess because in a way, like, it is a massive machine, I'm going to rephrase this as a question to you. So I look at Trek as a massive machine. It is a massive machine now, and it felt like it was one in the 90s. Was it? I mean, it felt like it was, but was it, you know, kind of like, oh, yeah, everyone, all hands on deck, and it's all go? Or did it feel like, well, look, that room is DS9. You know, those three or four rooms are Voyager, because I know there was a lot of effort went into this, certainly the early years of Voyager, because it was the UPN, it was the big flagship show, and there's been so much talk of DS9.
Well, we're a network show. We're not just syndicated. We're a network show. A crappy little dinky network, but we're a network show.
Exactly. Like, you know, I have this. Yes, but it doesn't really mean anything, but I have it. All right. Okay, that's fine. kind of being in and around Trek, obviously, as you have been and as Janet has been, you know, did you observe that kind of feeling of, everyone's just cogs in a machine? Or was it, obviously, we all wanted to be like, oh, everyone was family, you know?
No, yeah. When they use that phrase, well-oiled machine, it's not to depersonalize anything. There was friendly rivalry between the series, absolutely. But a lot of people worked, you know, Bob Blackman designed both series, costumer. Mike Westmore oversaw makeup both series. Mike and Denise worked on both series. It got, you know, Rick did kind of at the beginning. Rick Sternbach did kind of at the beginning. Doug Drexler kind of did on the art side. You know, there were different art departments for the two, but some people ran back and forth. And there are probably more that I'm not. Directors worked back and forth. I mean, directors aren't assigned to a series. They float back and forth. But there were enough people in place and producers. Peter Lauritsen was post-production producer. Dan Curry was visual effects producer over two teams on each show that alternated on each show. So there was a lot of continuity of look and feel that way. And then between the writing staffs, you know, that was basically Rick by the time you had different showrunners on both sides. But, you know, they were all like the writers were all in the Hart building. They all walked by each other, would kid around. And, you know, the boy, the DS9 writers got very clustered. but they were all in the same building. Everybody knew what was going on. So it was never to the point of nothing about Star Trek. Everybody was still fighting budgets, fighting times, trying to be creative, meet their deadlines and still do. I think by that time, you couldn't. I would always ask this when we would do our end of the year interviews that I've got, you know, 500 hours over here of from that time. You know, you didn't think about in your face, in your front of brain, whatever I'm doing right now, someone's going to look at it in 20 years. They're still going to be looking at it in 50 years because you'd be paralyzed. You just had to get through your work and do it. But in the back of their minds, unless the world just suddenly spun off its axis, by that time, they knew that, you know, what they were doing was going to be appreciated by people in the now and probably down the line. So they were always, you know, even in slow motion, early days, internet and feedback and things, they knew people would, everybody had opinions. Whether it was that show, saw that episode was crap, or that was a great idea, but you didn't bring it off, or why did the phasers come out of, why did the tractor beam come out of the phaser mount on the front of the D, you know? So they knew they would get feedback, but generally the numbers were going up and that was the best. And then you got into the malaise of the, you know, post TNG years when the audience split and went to crappy stations and the numbers kept going down and down. And until you got to the deep, dark secret of failed little Enterprise. But the dirty little secret there is Ron's Galactica was such a darling and a hit on Sci-Fi Network, you know, which was cable. Mm. The little secret was even with Enterprise on crippled little UPN was like 99th out of the top 100, or no, it was like 92nd out of the top 100 shows in the Nielsen ratings, and everything else on UPN, it was the top rated show on UPN, but it itself was at the bottom. But even then, given the nature of broadcast versus like cable, it was really like a tiny fish in a big pond versus Galactica being a big fish in a small pond, if you know that metaphor, because someone explained to me, pointed out to me one time that even when it was limping home to its early finish and Galactica was getting all the praise and love, the 1 year they overlapped in time, the last year of Enterprise, first year of Galactica, Enterprise still had a million more viewers a week than Galactica did.
That was actually something that's come up a couple of times, because I remember reading somebody who used to said, if Galactica had been on, say, Paramount, or if it had been on Fox or something, it never would have got past the first year because they never did the numbers for it. It was purely, I know Universal backed it, but yeah, it was because Sci-Fi basically said, well, look, this is doing well. We're getting a bit of prestige for this. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm delighted, big Galactica fan, love it. I've told
it's
this
just all about the perception and the no. It's like if you're a big, if you've got a book and you take it to Random House or something, or Simon and Schuster, you're one out of a billion. But if you go to Fred's print label over here, who's still
God bless Fred,
you know, they're like, yes, we'll take that. But you know the scale of what you're going to get out to. And then if you're a hit, then they truly love you and they will love you forever because you were the big hit when they were small and new and tiny. You know, but you got that's what got you in the door at the beginning, knowing what you were going to know anyway.
Yeah. Well, that was it. Actually, what was your foot in the door moment? What was your because obviously I know like this is before now we're talking about pitching for Voyager. This is so you're right because you've written like so many companion pieces. Like you have been like Dr. Trek, I think, is a very apt description for you. Like. Well, You're
thank
kind
you
of
one of my fan friends. It's a business friend. He made me. I was like, that's so he's like, you need a thing. You need a tagline. You need a, you know, and I'm like, oh, no, because author, editor, interviewer, host, you know, comma, chameleon on down the line doesn't it's like it's too big and bulky and you need something snappy. And that was back to a fan letter thing I did in our club back home. Anyway, it works. I finally got over myself and having it be, you know, tacky and goofy and corny, and it's fine. It works. What foot in the door?
Yeah. So I was like, you know, you're kind of like, oh, I've been paid to do something about Star Trek now.
Ah, okay. Well, I guess that would be, aside from the day I realized that if I went to a convention and came back to my newspaper and wrote a feature story, I could deduct the costs of the trip. So like in 80, so like savvy the first business. Interviews I have on tape of Mark Leonard and Dee and Michelle and a couple of producers from Star Trek IV, I was like, oh, I mean, it was still pennies, but it was like, oh, this can be a thing. But the big one was when I was I loved the Concordance, Bijou's Concordance. I love the tech manual. When Next Generation, but I always had my own notes in Bijou's book. I was either correcting things, but also like writing down other things that I wish had been tracked. Or I reorganized book and I would type my own thing up, you know, from the making of, which has no index in it. And you just had to kind of remember where the paragraph about phasers or the paragraph about everybody's biographies was. So when Next Generation's news announced, I said, I'm going to do two birds with one stone. I'm going to watch it. I'm going to do Bijou's thing for my own sanity. I'm going to concordantize it, as I'd say then. And I'm going to use that to learn this newfangled Macintosh. We had an evangelista in our newsroom who was tied into people and could tell me all the latest info. And I'm going to see if I can do that, because I started off doing it on index cards just the same way Bijou had done, like an index card for everybody, everything, every goofy little mention, whatever, and tagging it to an episode so you knew where it was from. And within a year, though, I got introduced to FileMaker and my little Macintosh Plus, but desktop publishing was new because you could afford to have laser printers. And so now instead of typing, type your keyboard, but you have the file and then you could also format it in primitive ways, but you could format it and print it out and I forced FileMaker into making pages that look like Bijou's pages, like where you have the synopsis and all but the main thing for me, like you can get credits anywhere, but the main thing for me was the concordance and, you know, see all each episode. And here's all the references from that episode. You know, like Memory Alpha is now. But Memory Alpha came right out of what Bijou first did, which was before any other show, any other entertainment property. Again, Star Trek is pioneering this. And then I did that every year for Next Generation. I printed about 50 or 100, sold them locally. I had a mail list of about 30 people. And the day that I saw Richard Arnold, problematic person, but RIP now, Gene's assistant, at a con, and I invited him to Oklahoma City, but I sent him the first copy first year of the TNG1, and he blew his top and said, oh my god, because our writers, all they can do is send their assistants down to go dig through old scripts, you know, and they have the file that no one else had, but still. And so he's like, this is awesome, I'm gonna copy this because you can't own it. But you should be doing this. Bijou is supposed to be working on a new one, but she hasn't. We're sending her the scripts and she's not doing anything yet. So after year two and year three and year four, and that turned into I'm on vacation, oh, come do a set visit and talk and meet a couple more people. And I'm just like, okay, whatever. Yeah. This is nice. This is never going to happen, but fine. But that's why fine. And then I find out that it came down to me and the guy who was keeping notes for the Pocketbook authors to do the first. Making of. But I wanted to do a concordance. I wanted to do an encyclopedia, but I didn't know that Mike and Denise had just done this deal. And rather than reprinting Bijou's book and then doing a new one, they had the vision to combine everything together and just start having one, which was the smarter. Again, we're going from competing series to it's all one franchise. So they said, if you don't do an encyclopedia, because I'm thinking if this ever does sell, I've done it already. It's all done. There it is. I might tweak it and add to it, but it's 95% done. So they say, well, we've got this happening, but can you do a making of book? And I'm like, okay, yes. You always say yes.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. We need it in 3 months. What? And you know, here I've got Stephen Whitfield's making of Star Trek floating in my mind. It's like, how am I going to do that in 3 months? And if I don't, then I'm going to be the crappy little book that Pocketbooks churned out and they're ripping fans off because it's so thin and flimsy. It's like, how am I going to do that in 3 months?
At what point of next gen is this? So, like, how much next gen do we
fourth
have?
Season, fifth season.
Fifth season. Okay.
And the tech manual took a year, was supposed to come out in fourth season, but it took them longer, Mike and Rick's tech manual. So it came out right before the companion did. They were supposed to be a year apart because Pocket was totally, they were so, you know, there'd been no nonfiction other than the original series and none of that since, I mean, Mr. Scott's Guide was still talking about the A in the movie world and that was a proven thing, but that was like 85 and 86. And so they were very wary about how much is this new show going to sell? So they waited till fourth season. Now the damn, you know, the post Best of Both Worlds boom was on and the ratings were crazy. And they were doing ads about the ratings, fourth season, fifth season. So they were, you know, Pocket was way behind the curve of what the fan did. And there were a lot of fan made fanzines like mine and others. And of all of that, they were looking at mine and it looked nice because it was laser printed. So it looked like real printing, but they liked the quality of mine, I guess, but it was between Sean and I, and which is funny because I wound up meeting him in LA running the WhoCon here, Gallifrey One every year. We've met years later, which is funny, just the way I met Jeff Mandel years later in the art. People that I wrote with, you know, snail mail, we were too poor to do long distance calling back in the day. So everything was by letter, which is great now because I have this archive of how we hashed canon and background things out. But that was the foot in the door. That was the foot in the door. I get this call, Larry, we'd like you to do the TNG companion. Oh my God. Oh my God. And they're calling me in Oklahoma. Now we need you to do it in 3 months. Oh my God. And blah, blah, blah. And do you have an agent? No. Well, we've got somebody who's being a first time agent for people. So it was kind of like, it wasn't handed to me because I had done all this sweat and grunt rope where I just had to do a 90 degree turn and do it. And then quickly learn that when you come out as the conquering hero, as an official licensed author, no one gives a flying fuck.
Yeah.
It's like people are working on a show and they're all hell bent to get into their vacations. And the hoops that are supposed to be there, the media relations, licensing had to talk to media relations who had to then beg off on production. And it was a huge education in the way the world worked. And I kind of pushed myself out there. I'm not a big pushy person, especially back then. And but I had the person from the private vendor, not Paramount publicity, because there wasn't such a thing for TV and for Star Trek. But the hired vendor to do the PR was screaming at me that if I went on the lot because of people I knew already, but if I went over there, they would not be responsible for what I did. Like I was going to go burn down the stages and steal the sets or something. It was like insane. They're so paranoid. And I'm like, you know, I was chosen to do this. This is, you know, none of that mattered. And all of that drama and the way where people are has served me well. That and having a theater degree, having a journalism degree and being a fan and kind of balancing all of that out. And then learning the way Hollywood circles worked and the reality of the way people work. Yeah. Which I've been very grateful for because after that, I had to do everything myself. I had to get people's trust. Nobody opened the door and said, here is our official author. So please give him an hour of your time. Okay, fine. Goodbye. No, it was like I had to person to person to person, you know, have people introduce me. And that was more long lasting for over the long haul. So after the book was done, I just kept interviewing people. Because we had the red book. So the blue edition was 92. And then when the seventh season was done and the first movie Generations was done and they had the plan for what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And then by that time, DS9, you know, and I was originally supposed to, well, there was for about 5 seconds, I was supposed to do the DS9 companion, but the left hand and right hand at Pocket, they'd already promised it to one hand had already promised it to Paula and Terry. And the other hand had to kind of come back and say, oh, I'm so sorry. But then I wound up getting steered into the Fact Files, which as someone not of the US, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
I know so exactly what
that
you're talking
was
about,
way yes. more lucrative than doing any little dinky books for Pocket over the years. So anyway, so, you know, and then by that time it all kind of blew up and I was the license the way that Dayton is doing now with licensed projects. We didn't have titles and all that, but that was kind of me in the 90s and the early aughts was, if there's a licensed event or project going on, go get Larry because he knows the archives and he's got his own tape record that has no commercials. You know, he's got all of his own notes. And so that was that. But if you want to say it was that phone call, it was having Richard take my book back and then things building up and people just knowing me and then having them decide to let me do the companion. I wasn't even pitching that. It was they came to me.
All right. There's something.
There's your 20-minute answer to a question. Sorry.
That is great. Hey, this is great. It's the easiest podcast I've ever done. I've barely had to speak. You know,
I am
not at all, no, because I'm about to ask you another question that potentially might have a long-ish answer. Because this is a question that I'm coming up on the spot, but I know myself and my dad. So it's my dad. It's my dad's fault that I'm a Trekkie, right? So everyone who doesn't like the fact that I'm a Trekkie, Paul Ferrick, it's his fault.
All right.
And I will say, I don't think he realized what he was doing at the time, but he was like, hey, have you ever heard of this little thing? I think it was, I know I watched Animated because it was running on Saturday mornings in the 90s, but I'm fairly certain Next Gen was my first one, but I've massively digressed. I remember being in my local newsagents and looking up, and there was this brightly colored, very kind of like almost plastic looking magazine with a big number one on it. And I believe it was the Enterprise D. And actually, to be even more specific, I think it was the 4-foot model, that the filming model that they used on that one. Just in case anyone thought, like, you know, oh, maybe Sean is cool. Sean's not cool. That's fine. And it was Star Trek Fact Files issue number one. And here I was, and it was Dublin in Ireland. It was, you might know the year. It was
97, early 97. I think 96, because we started working in 96, but I was just reading something that said it debuted in 97, early 97.
Because I was
Sample tested somewhere in England, and then after that, they got the green light and went full bore. Yeah.
That seems like, because I look at what the Fact Files was, and I go, that's Memory Alpha in print. I don't think this is a controversial thing to say. Like, I think an awful lot of what Memory Alpha is comes from the Star Trek Fact Files, because they're so detailed and there's so many. You know, I mean, like, I had my parents' hearts broken and also some of the floorboards broken with the weight of these multiple binders, because I collected. I know I didn't go all the way up to the end because basically I ran out of money, but they're so detailed. So I promised you a question.
And paid well.
Well, now, so there we go. What was the process? How long was the process from start to finish? And then when did you kind of know? Because I think am I right in saying it didn't cover Enterprise? Is that right?
I'm trying to think. Well, we may have had some basic ones because it ended in 2000. I basically remember it was 6 years. It was 96 to 02.
Oh, okay.
And I think we had some baby steps in toward Enterprise there at the end, but I don't see, you know, the main office was in London. It was two or three people at the beginning, but for the main run, it turned over, but there was an American contingent because we were here on the ground and the plans changed from day one. And oh my gosh, the history of the Fact Files could be like the history of the experience in Vegas. But there were three, they approached Mike and Denise and Gar and Judy Rhys-Stevens and me. They looked at who had written books and said, would you want to write at the beginning? Gar and Judy did briefly, but then they realized how overwhelming it was and they had an actual life to go to. Mike and Denise begged out because they instantly perceived that, or the story came down, was that it would have come across as, it was so in-depth that it would come across as competing with anything Pocket would do in print, although it was technically a magazine, not a book. Licensing was slicing up the licenses this way. And it was back when there was domestic and foreign, which the Fact Files helped change and just made everything by category, not category and is it domestic or is it foreign? Like domestic publishing and foreign publishing, say. Mm. Because it wound up being like the number three moneymaker of anything Paramount did in licensing. And so the domestic people were going, oh, well, the stepchildren, the global side, have this huge moneymaker. So we need to make that for everybody, basically, in the world of 1998 or whatever. But yeah, so, I mean, the office, aerospace, they came up with the lesson plans. They came up with the issue plans. And then I would get after writing, they needed somebody to shepherd the art because they were told up front that there were, you know, there's all kinds of artwork and specs for the D or for the bird of prey. Mm. But when you get down to the, you know, the Koanonian's ship, I mean, or when you get down to something really obscure, it's like, no, there's nothing. And in the old days, they'd take a ship and, you know, redress it 15 times. Mm-hmm. The lesser ships, the not hero ship. So maybe there was a bad Polaroid that Image G or the visual effects team took of that early ship, and that's all there is photographically of it before it got changed. And that hard reality, we need to have a series. I saw what was coming. And when you had two series cranking out new material, even if one of them was just Delta Quadrant, you know, fake people, but if, you know, they weren't Romulans and Klingons or Cardassians, but if they're cranking out all this canon every week, as beloved as the encyclopedia was, I knew Mike and Denise, they were working on the shows. They didn't have time, much less they had done it as PDFs. So they had this great creative control. But any updating of it was going to always be reshuffling page layouts because they had all that inset art, and it was a Herculean task to do updates of the encyclopedia. And I was watching my kids having these little thin science booklets, paperbacks. And I'm like, if you did that as like binder pages or something, you could reprint a small book easily, have different chapters on ships and planets and uniforms and cultures and whatever, and divvy up the categories that way. And that way you could update it without having to worry about this massive combined encyclopedia type format and just have it be about that. And then when you do that, have artwork, have notes, have all this. But it was a thing that you could update because right now people are screaming. Cosplay wasn't even a word, hadn't come over from anime yet, but people were still doing their costumes and building props and, you know, presenting and just being tech heads and being canon nerds or whatever we called it in the 90s. And they wanted the stuff. And Pocket was sitting, rightly, because of the cost. They were sitting on the laurels of the encyclopedia. Oh, we just did this huge, massive thing. And we just updated it with this clunky add-on the back update. That'll last for 3 or 4 years. It's like, no, you've got 2 hours a week being cranked out by these shows. And their numbers are starting to go downhill. You would think you would try to create as much excitement as you could. Well, a lot. So I pitched this idea. It didn't go anywhere. Well, along comes from across the pond this brilliant idea. No one in the hell knew what a part work was in the States, but this brilliant idea of doing exactly everything that I had said needed to be done, could be done, and money made from it. Totally not my brain, you know, totally alien idea from a different angle. But when it came down and they came to me and I saw what it was like, well, yes, this is what I said 2 years ago. Like, this is what I've been saying for the last couple of years. This would meet all these needs, fan hungers, and you would make a shitload of money, Paramount. And they would too.
And so the people it did. Are just like, well, why happened. Didn't you say that, Larry? I did tell you that.
There was, but not anymore. So my part then wound up being, here are the plans. And I was doing some writing, but they got into a point where it wasn't just sashay into the archives and pull all the art we need, because in a lot of times there's 10% of the art we need for those artists that are doing those exploded views and close-ups of sets and all that and props. The degree they planned on giving to people that they sold it on after they ran through the obvious ships and obvious things, the first, you know, 5%, the other 95% was not sitting there just somebody to waltz in and pull the reference and go. So then it turned into they needed somebody to see what was there, make the most of what it was, and then maybe chase down more, like individual visual effects people, prop people, makeup people, costume people, vendors who weren't on staff. They all had their own files, and thank God they did, because that's the way the industry works. I'm going to take a picture of this before I send it over to the show. And since it's Star Trek, I want this for 40 years later. And the smart ones were like, they'll probably botch this in record keeping and photography. I'm going to take my own best example ever, the original Orions, the original Bobby Sue Luther on Borderland. Boy, I can still pull that out. I was like, this is awesome. Orions on Enterprise. This is awesome. So you had like photo shoots of her, right? Well, we've got the photography from the set. You did like high res back in the day. You didn't just do 35 millimeters. You did like high res that we can do posters and magazine covers with, right?
we got the photographer from the set. It's like, oh my God. No. People are going to want this.
Thank God the guy who developed the makeup that didn't wear off that they used took his own pictures. And everything you saw of her out of that episode that was large was from the guy who invented the makeup, not from the studio. But that's the kind of thing, you know, that happens. So anyway, that's what I did for the fact files for all six. I wrote some, but I did that. And then I had to describe what I was doing. And then I also did a list of here's what they were pioneering frame grabbing. Oh my God, we could go on this forever, Sean. You got me going now. Frame grabbing was still a science that Gary Hutzel, the late great Gary Hutzel, would do a photo setup for $300 and then put a ship or a prop or something on a stand and shoot different angles for $50 a pop. So every ship was going to cost, you know, a few hundred dollars to get reference photos, to get it out of the crate, put it up and all this. Because frame grabbing was go into the bay, run the videotape or whatever, the best available original film before it went to tape compositing and pull it out of the, you know, go set it up, go do the thing. And in the middle of doing the episodes, sit down, have some hours and shoot this. And it was going to be, you know, three or four times. Anyway, they figured out that the official prints and tapes are all in London too, as part of the license. And they figured out the deal with the in-country, go down there, much cheaper, much faster. They didn't charge an arm and a leg. I mean, Gary was being competitive in LA. He wasn't being and he wasn't pocketing the money himself. It was going into. So Fact Files found a way to get frame grabs for a tenth the price that it cost anybody in LA to do. And so we had frame grabs finally. And so I did the list of here's what we have. Here's what we need frame grabs of. And I did that list so that in London, they could run down and tell them exactly what to get and where. This episode, this act, we didn't get into time codes, but it was like this episode about here, you know. So I was the guy that did that all. Now, I didn't do the back end. I had friends that, you know, there were times when I was like, oh, this should have been copy edited this way and that way. But on the front end, I was the guy that got all that together and then told them what to do with it and where they had a hole and now go get this frame grab. And I did that for 6 years.
Did the, you know, because of the
as process, they kept extending, they did 98 at first because no part work ever went that long. So Star Trek busted the paradigm of part works for the part work world.
Well, I remember specifically.
I looked the other day, 304 issues is where it finally ended.
304.
Being extended a bit at a time all the way along because they kept thinking, okay, now it's going to die off. Now it's going to die off. And it finally did.
Did the process of getting those kind of screen grabs, did that help decide the order? Because obviously things were released out of order. Like, because one of the things was the episode. You know, I for the life of me, I can't remember. I don't know.
They just did random. I don't know what the magic was to picking what's what.
Okay. I was thinking, was it because
I would just get the issue plans? Here's the topics in each issue. Like, here's the six topics in each issue. Great. So we need the photo support. And then what happened on the writing was finally I became the guy who wound up doing the tech writing for the layman, like how the transporter works. And the tricky thing was, and I knew the people right across the lot and we're friends. It was like so much of it, the detail was what Mike and Rick wrote in the tech manual, say. How the transporter works, you know, all the, so it was like, how do you, so on one hand, it was work for hire. Nobody owned that stuff. But on the other hand, it was Mike and Denise's work, just like mine. It's like my writing was my writing, but it was owned by the franchise. So it's like the line of walking, like, how do you take all the minutiae that a fan wants that's now been, you know, if a writer was picking it up and using that bit in the script somewhere, which happened all the time, that's what it was for. Then yay, now it's aired and it's kind of out there. But I always had to walk a line between not getting too much of Mike and Denise's or Mike's original detail, say from the tech manual or Rick's versus what was the story length of the thing. And then on top of that, just making it not gobbledygook, not making it techno babble for, you know, for the other 90% of fans who weren't tech heads. So that was a fun. So those were like the ones that it's like the kind of thing that nobody else wanted to write. People would do synopsis and do character biographies and do the fun stuff. And I would kind of get the can you make sense of this for lay people? And at the same time, you know, not offend Mike and Rick.
that's actually funny in a way, because when I got the job with Trek Culture,
it was a smaller world.
Must be that there's a team of only a few of us. But no, you're funny, right? Because when I got the job at Trek Culture, my boss told me, I was like, right, what can you do for us? And I had a list of this and that. And he was like, right, just one thing. Don't do episode synopses. I was kind of thinking, like, you know, a part of me died that day. And I was just like, hang on, I can close my eyes and hit play on the cage and probably not have to stop until I hit about midway through Next Gen, you know, just from my memory. And he was like, no, because that's out there. That's on Wikipedia. That's on Memory
Thank
Alpha.
You. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. That's exactly what I said. Only to have one of my editors along the way say, well, you know, the synopsis are the most important part of the companion. And I'm like, you can get that's exactly what I said. You can get that anywhere. That's the easiest thing to do. That's the least needed. Oh, this is yeah.
So I in that yeah, right there. We did a list there recently, and actually you reminded me because of you mentioned the transporter. And it was 10 secrets of the 10 things you need to know about the transporter. And of course, a lot of it is, you know, from you know, kind of well, your writing and Mike's writing and everything. Then there was one where I said, right, I'm going to go real geeky on this entry. And I started talking about the Heisenberg compensator and everything. And the amount of people who went, we really liked that. You talked about that. We really liked the minutia. And I'm just like, yes, I am not an island. Everyone likes hearing about this stuff. This is brilliant. We'll see how they feel when I get to warp drive. But, I've done warp drive. All right, phasers, I think, is the next one up. Is there, I mean, this is possibly a very hard question to answer, but is there like, say, from, let's stick with the fact files. Is there like a happiest memory of like a, I'm effing delighted that one went out, or maybe the reaction to a certain topic, a certain thing that you've written. And if fact files is maybe too small, I think, but from expand it as long as you like, what is it? What is a great memory that you're like, you know what? This is great. My life is deadly right now.
The fact files is such a blur aside from a few moments, but in all of it, one of the things that I'm still most proudest of is stellar cartography back there. Cause that had been my goofy little hobby. It's how I met Jeff Mandel by long distance. I've told you not long distance calling. We were riding long distance, yep. New York to Oklahoma. And then to meet in the art department for generations in 94, and then to him to get on and work. Part of that New York Trek Mafia that was Doug and Doug Drexler and Anthony Fredrickson and the people that worked on the original, the giant poster book that was so cool and so like unknown. But it was like, oh, my God, look, they're actually focusing on the more than the black and white photo in the making of. They're talking about the medical props that weren't in the tech manual. Not until the medical reference, but then I'm back in the weeds. No, when basically Jeff had done the book, Jeff Mandel did the Star Maps book in 02 and when he was working on Enterprise and kind of did this like, just like Mike and Doug had done, did a synergy of, I'm going to do my work for the show. Yes, I'm a fan. I'm putting way more effort into what I'm doing on the show than any other person in this position would be doing for the pay and the time and all that. Because I'm a fan and I'm, you know, all the accoutograms with not just the in jokes, but the like charts that talk about class names that I'm tracking or the room numbers on the D and I'm tracking this in my little database that I have no business doing, but because it's Star Trek and because I know that people are going to look at this eventually in high def and eventually 20 and 50 and 100 years from now, I want it to, you know, and I know how I felt and I know what didn't happen always with the original series, but we're going to fight that now because we've got computers and graphics and Macs and okay. So Jeff is doing that with like the star charts in Enterprise because everything is close in because it's early days and they're not going very fast and it's all very real astronomy overlaid. So he's doing a lot of the work and then does the Star Maps book and it comes out and that's awesome. And then we have the fallow years within a couple of years and nothing happens. So the first cool thing comes along and I know they approached him probably first and he's doing other things, but he's like, I'll do one. They wanted to do the 10 maps. They came up with the conceit before I did and came to me about it. And then we tweaked a little bit. But basically, instead of having a book that fans were ripping pages out and scanning together, it's like, I just want the big fucking map, damn it. I don't want a little book with pages. And so to meet that demand that was out there, they came up with the 10 big photo page or the map posters of different kinds and cultures and historical periods, which was kind of where I started having input. Instead of just having it be more maps, how can we make that different and cool?
Yeah.
And then the guidebook they wanted with it, which at the beginning was just all this little throwaway book to go with it. But there was a chapter, a 4-page chapter for each big map. And one of those, one of the maps was the Dominion War. Now, I know watching the Dominion War shows fly by on DS9, all those cool battle maps they got into. But when you look at them, they don't make any sense and they're intentionally vague because Mike and Doug were having to crank shit out constantly through all that. And the writers didn't have a big plan for anything. It was one thing to have a map of Bajor. That was amazing on a whiteboard. But other than that, they had no big plan for how things were laid out. And you know, this is the late 90s and Mike had his basic quadrants and where the basic empires were. But other than that, there was no big nothing. And Jeff's work was 5 years away. So they were intentionally vague on those maps. And occasionally you'd see something specific, but it wouldn't make sense distance, whatever. So looking at that to do a map, basically one of the things I'm proud of is I basically choreographed. There was one big Tyra that had the big battle. They first get their butts kicked. They come limping back. That's the kickoff to the, I think, season 6. And it's like, that's never explained or talked about. And I came up with a thing and loving history and maps the way I do, because I came to Star Trek as a history buff and a NASA kid, not so much a sci-fi person. But knowing the way the Atlantic was for the Atlantic and the Pacific were for World War II is basically that and a little bit of the first Persian Gulf War. And taking some history models, I basically made everything make sense in the Dominion War. I choreographed the Dominion War, everything from, oh, if Beta Z falls, then that's a direct attack on Earth and Vulcan. It's like, well, but they're way over here. How does that work? Well, it was like if you can get past the border in Iraq, it's a straight road to Baghdad kind of idea. But also this thing about the north and the south, it's space, I know, but on a 2D map. Anyway, basically with a couple of tweaks, you know, I made up, including the fact they kept talking about the alpha quadrant powers when the Klingons and Romulans were supposedly, which Memory Alpha had a hissy fit about for 10, 12 years because of that original map in Conspiracy. Things evolve, guys. Things have always evolved. Go with what the preponderance of evidence goes to. Voyager was already showing you the quadrants, yada, yada, yada. Okay. But I came up, you know, who first uses the term alpha quadrant powers? The Dominion does. What is the Dominion's point of view? They come out of the wormhole in the alpha quadrant.
That's what ergo, they see. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
The real world reason was that the Ira and the guys all knew what the reality was, but they said, we'll be damned if we're going to have characters on TV say terms like the alpha beta quadrant powers. It's like, that's too much to say. They were fully aware of it. They weren't going to say that. So the conceit is that just like them, the shorter form made sense. Nobody had to stop in DS9 time and go, wait a minute, aren't the Klingons and Romulans actually in the beta? Nobody cared. It was a Dominion phrase that everybody else just picked up on at times. But obviously, by definition, they're not anyway. But coming up with a conceit like that and then kind of, so yes, if I did nothing else for Star Trek, and not that it's a huge bestseller and the whole world revolves around it, but all the creatives that do work on the shows now, they all use the established map that's evolved from, you know, the basic from Mike through Jeff and through what I've done with it the last couple of times. And that's thrilling to see Tim Peel and Andrew Jarvis that did graphics, the main key interfacers, everybody using, so that when you see, and now on Strange New World, when you see those very bold and in your face maps, they're doing it confidently because they're taking, you know, and then when they locate something new, they locate it right where they feel like it needs to be. And it's the writers, you know, doing the locating, which is awesome for the key thing for story points. Yeah. So that's been an aha thing. And in a big picture, all of it, but in a tiny way, knowing that when Mike and Doug and the writers were throwing up their hands about keeping a continuity to the, it's easy to do something. It's easy to retcon something. So rather than being in the trenches with it. So I guess maybe I'm thinking forgetting something else, but I always am very proud that I tried to make sense of the Dominion War.
Well, that is incredible. Now you're saying that whether Stellar Cartography was a big seller or not, I can tell you that two of those copies, one was purchased by myself, and I have it in the next room. And the other one that I know of was purchased by our editor at large of Trek Culture, Chris Thompson, who was the one who bought it it arrived and he literally rang me and says, I don't care what you're doing. Get on Amazon and buy this now. This is incredible. And he was right. The detail, it is everything a Trekkie wants in a map. And I love, again, you have it. Actually, funny enough, aesthetically, I love the Vulcan one. Because I just love that color palette, and I love the.
It was supposed to be what do you have to? It was supposed to be not looking very Earth-centric, Federation modern. Like, what do you? What is ancient? You have to go with the scroll work because that's ancient Vulcan, and then you have to. It's an ancient mental. I was just afraid. I was sad that we couldn't make the Cardassian and the Romulan and Klingon maps a little more out there with, you know. It's hysterical because there's, you'd think after all, and the Klingons, there's tons out there, but you'd think with Romulans and I was looking online to see what fans had done, what had, you know, I'm thinking, sure, there's been fan artwork. Well, if it is, it's not all, or it wasn't 9 years ago, you know, what's digitized and online. And I was really, and especially the Romulans, like, really, guys, really? And then it hit me. It was like Rick's rug for the Senate. In Nemesis, say what you will about Nemesis, but it had that awesome, but I remembered. And I'm like, Rick, do you still have an original art piece for the rug? And yes. So he sent it to me. And the little icons that denoted, you know, they had a map icon for Romulan worlds and a thing for Federation worlds. I'm like, yes, I have some Romulan map art. So all the Romulan things from that are right off the rug from the Senate room. But it was like, that was on me to do. At the 11th hour, you know, and so I got that to whichever map artist it was that did that one. But that was kind of where you know, that's kind of where it is sometimes. Just like the writers or anybody, you hear a story later on and say, well, we were sitting there at 4 o'clock on Sunday and I had to have it on set by 7 a.m. the next day, blah, blah, blah. So
I can just imagine it's like, let's just assimilate him. Anyway, next. I'd like to ask you, if you want, I'd love to know more about Portal 47.
I would love to tell you.
If you wouldn't mind.
You hear where I come from. One of the crystal memories I had was when we would go to, they're over now, the last one was this year, but in Oklahoma, it was a 12-hour drive to Denver, but I would go up to the Starland Con, Starfest and StarCon, because to me, that's what a Star Trek con, especially by the 80s and 90s, should have been like. And it's how far I had to go to get to something dependable every year that I could depend on. First, Patrick Stewart's first convention was Starfest in Denver, and I was there. It was the weekend that Heart of Glory first aired, and it aired on Saturday nights. And he wouldn't talk about it on Saturday, but on Sundays he had, you know, hour Saturday, hour Sunday, and on Sunday he would talk about it. And he praised Michael up and down the. And there's tape of that somewhere. The whole thing. And also that Saturday, he wanted to see, it was his first convention, and he wanted to see if he still had his stage lungs after a year of a TV stage. And he did his entire, and this is like a hall with 2,000 people in it. You know, it was a hotel convention ballroom space converted to hold 1,000 people. And there were some, it wasn't just completely a motel flat space. It had some rake to it. But he did the entire hour without a mic. He was like projecting. He was going Globe Theater.
Like that's
seriously impressive. And the second day he talked about Michael Dorn and he said, and with your indulgence, I'm going to use a mic today. But I will never forget and him coming out and he just, it was like waves of warm. And Dee was the other guest. So it was like you had Dee and then you had Patrick and it was just this like waves of, he came out and it was like visibly like reacting to the waves of love and applause and kind of like step back for a minute. And he says something like, well, I must tell you, that was as warm a welcome as anyone could have to this new, you know, but it was, I was sitting there going, watching history. I missed all this with the originals. That was part of it. It was like, you know, I missed the first 10 years of the old guys, but I'm seeing it now. And I, you know, I'll never forget this, but Jesus, I forgot the question you asked me.
Portal 47.
Portal 47. I would sit in those awesome cons with Jonathan and Michael and Marina once a year, whatever. And people in the audience would say, and I already knew this. This was me and like reading Interstat and going, okay, fine. But why do 9/10 of the people want to talk for the millionth time about Spock and not get into all the rest of the universe of Trek? What's, I mean, but it didn't crystallize. And it really crystallized when I'm sitting in that audience in the 90s. And Jonathan would say, somebody would ask a question, John said, you know what? That's a Michael Westmore question. Or, you know what? That's a Bob Blackman question. Or you know what? That's a Dan Curry question. Or you know what? That's a Michael Piller question. And I would always in my head silently scream, then why aren't they on stage? You know, it's like, gosh, yeah. Jonathan, we love you. Love the stories. But can we get the people that really run the shows and make what we see on screen? Can we get them? Okay. Well, that's kind of what my, and I love actors and they have stories too. And a lot of them direct now. So they're actually like worth walking the planet. No, I'm kidding. Totally kidding. No, it's just about everybody gravitates to the actors. That's the face of the show. That's the way it should be. They make the most money, yada, yada, potentially. As even Rick Berman had to find out eventually. But it's like, but that's not what, the, if you're after the first go round of a show, of watching an episode or two or three, after you've been around the block with it, around the sector, you want to know more, you're going to have to get beyond what the actor's going to tell you and get into, and the writers are a natural next step. And then it's like, well, whose name is on it? And then who really did the polish? Who really went in prophecy? Who really brought in the bit about the Kuvama disease and whatever? And who had the, you know, it's like, find out that. And there's how many episodes now? Every episode is its own little story that way. And then who did the prop, the visual effect, the set, what was involved with that? And what was not done? And why? And what was the tone for the whole season? Whether it was only 10 or it was 26 fuckers. Oh, did I say that? So, yeah. So that was what it was like. So that's what I wanted to know. But I knew, remember, there were only 8 guys like me in the whole country. It's like, that'll never fly. It'll be me. I'll have TechCon and it'll be me and 10 other people and 20 guests and we'll all be happy and go insanely bankrupt. Well, now we have the world we have today. And that's what Portal 47 is basically in a nutshell. It's bringing all those voices of people out. And as I say, it's for all the Star Trek fans who have no idea how much Star Trek they still have no idea about.
I really like that description because when you sit down, pick any episode, let's say we all pick our favorite episodes, whatever it is, and you start to get into the behind the scenes. And then if you're like anything like me, which obviously we are, you start to be like, right, grind. Yes. But I had a thing recently where we were trying to find the exact material that the original transporter wall was made out of. That's how in deep we were trying to go. We're like, you know, kind of, and I know through, and I, there's no judgment, but there's people that will be like, you sad, sad person. I'll be like, that's, you know what? That's cool. That, you know, I will accept that judgment. So if there, you know, if we get interviews with people who are responsible for this, for people who are archiving this, for people who are happy to discuss all of this, then that is absolutely where folks like me will gravitate toward. Now,
if you build it, they will come.
Literally 100%. Larry, you've been very generous with your time. So I'm going to, I feel like this should be a mini series because there's so many things I want to ask and discuss, but there is one big question.
The scary thing is, Sean, someone a month or two ago said something about, so when are you going to do a book? And I'm like, oh, like not a Trek nonfiction book or something, because I've got those in mind. But like do my own. I'm just like, oh God, am I that old? Okay. But so Doug's working on it. Doug Drexler's working on a memoirs. Dan Madsen's working on a memoirs. I'm like, oh, okay, I should kind of start thinking about this.
Probably.
Maybe I should just like get a transcript of every podcast I've ever been on. And that would do it.
I mean, first of all, surely you can at this stage. And second of all, remember, it's memoirs volume 1.
Well, the Shatner thing. Yes.
Yeah, but exactly. Yes. You know, kind of
always leave room in the title for more. Yeah. More movie memories. More TV.
I'm still here. No, I'm. So yeah. So this is, you know, it's a completely easy question, not big at all. What does Star Trek mean? What is the biggest lesson? What is it to you? What does Star Trek, you know, what is the biggest lesson you take from Star Trek?
It is a fun and exciting and even science-based entertainment that lets you hope for a better future and have a lot of fun along the way in a consistent way that doesn't change just because the decades are going by. You can depend on it to not just be optimistic and diverse, but to be its own to be its own thing. It doesn't jerk you around, you know, to be blunt, it doesn't reboot every 3 years. Some people may say that, but in the, they've said that since 1973. So, yeah. Or 79 or 82 or get on board here. So yeah, it tries to be cohesive. So it's worth investing in. So hopefully for most people, the excitement that you had at one point still stays with you, even as the world wears you down and wears it down. There are moments when you can still be a little fanboy, fangirl, and still relive that original joy. Whatever the thing was that attracted, maybe it was the hope and optimism, maybe it was the shiny ships and ray guns, maybe it was the strange new worlds and planets and stars. But whatever it is, you appreciate all of it, and it doesn't change. It tries to be cohesive decade after decade after decade. And it's been around long enough now where you don't have to train the professionals. Professionals are coming to it as fans. So actually it's getting better where they inherently know what to do. It's just a matter of now what's the politics and what's the pecking order and the ladder and what's the marching orders we have. That was a longer answer than you wanted, but that's there. As opposed to every other positive, and there are some, as opposed to the dystopian ones, but the positive aspirational franchises that are out there, unless it's Doctor Who where change is baked into the cake, it's the DNA, then for more or less, you know, don't do that. And it's the one that has the most hours on film.
We're well up over the 800 at this point.
Yes, yeah. You don't have to lean on comics or trading cards or something that might get yanked away at some point. It's on film. It's on screen. So it's there. And hundreds of hours more of it than anything else other than, like I said, Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. And Star Wars is there, but the not that it's about the math. It's not that it's a contest, but there's so many more hours of Star Trek on screen than Star Wars, even now. And little 10-episode seasons aren't going to cut it as a catch-up.
That's true. So yes,
and
so
not that it's a competition, and not that I'm being judgmental. I said this before. I'm just doing the math here. Yeah. So there's a lot of emotional investment, and there's a lot of material to pull from. Even if you aren't having to pay somebody cheaper in London to do the frame grabs for you, that's it. So I think, you know, if you're yearning for that heroic mythic, somebody in the 80s, 90s used to say that the Greeks had their mythic gods, and we had Star Trek by then. So it's kind of the same appeal.
I don't know how I
stuck the landing there very well, but that's it. But the difference between Star Trek and everything else is it's consistency. And yes, it bones up sometimes, but eventually everything gets smoothed by somebody. And it really stays consistent and doesn't get off on having four different Spider-Man or five different Batman or seven different James Bonds.
That's right. Challenge to all them, right? Put them in a seat. All right, okay. They did do that with Spider-Man, but we're fine. Larry, open invite to come back because I feel like there's so much more to discuss, but thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us today. This has been a treat. We're friends on Twitter now, so sorry for all the spamming you're going to get in advance. I say I'm sorry. I'm really not.
It's 2022, so you know, you kind of put up with that, but it's okay.
Exactly. Yeah.
No, Sean, you do such a great job. I mean, like I said, the first couple of years I had a Trekland Tuesdays Live, which by the way is slated so that everybody across the pond can jump in at 9 or 10, I think. Everything I do, I try to be global with it, including Portal 47. But I had an episode called Who Mocks the Mockers, where I was like, please, let's have some like normal, rational, commonsensical, not shills, but just people to be grounded to earth here and not just come out of the gate, you know, thinking it's got to be clickbait toxicity or else no one's going to follow my channel. And so since then we've had several rise up, and it's been fun to watch what you're doing, because you're doing I do the same thing with Jorg when he's doing his clipping. It's like, gosh, if I'd known in the 80s and 90s that everything I was doing in a hurry, if I was just taking screenshots, if I could have done screenshots, But if I just told the world every hour what I was doing and it would turn into a channel and a brand, it's like, gosh, I would have done it then. But it's fun to watch him do the thing that I just did like on the run in my notes. But he's pulling grabs because you can, you know, in a microsecond. But, you know, it's been fun to see that, A, there are more than eight people in the world that appreciate this and like to do it, and that it's all grown, and that you're out there online doing this. And I'm very envious and jealous that you've got the time to do exactly this niche of what you're doing. So, no, it's been a pleasure to come on. And the only thing I haven't mentioned is our location tours that we do, Trekland Treks. So we have events tied in, but anytime people are in L.A. and want to do a tour of film sites, let me know. And we will work with you ahead of time and work it out. So it's the best experience. And I lead you around and do whatever you need done. And you come away with some swag and have an awesome, your own personal away mission when you're in L.A. So anyway, LarryNemechek.com is the place. You can find all the pod sites and all the, you know, the Trek files and Portal 47 and all this stuff. There's a Trekland Treks thing right there.
That's very cool.
All of that's there at the site, but it's all, you've heard where I'm coming from. So anything I can do to bring that to people and keep it alive or open some more eyeballs or calm the disgruntled waters with something that makes you not even have to fight about that, then so that people can go find a new fight. Because they will. But that's what that's kind of what Trekland is all about.
That's brilliant. Larry, thank you so much. And also, like, if I'm ever in LA, I'm just going to say, just cancel whatever plans you have for the week. Just you know, I'm giving you fair warning. I will let you know as soon as I know myself. But because that sounds like, again, the kind of stuff that fans like me, we will eat that up.
I might have to coordinate a little bit with Janet on that whole week-long disappearance trick, but okay, we can work on it.
Wait. My people will talk to your people. You're fine.
Right,
you're fine.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. thank you so much. You are awesome. You're wonderful. You have obviously said as well, your website is LarryNemechek.com. I will put the description of that or the link.
Oh, wait,
to that
you're on YouTube, right?
Indeed, I am.
I need all of your YouTube. I got into the whole get the biggest viewership thing going, so I need everybody to go over and like and subscribe on the channel, because we've got Trekland. Cadet Alice and I record, my granddaughter and I talk about Prodigy. So there's a lot of actually fun stuff there and in the back catalog too.
Brilliant. So likewise, link to that will be in the description of this episode, because you, like, anyone looking for somebody with passion for Trek, look no further. So yeah, Larry, you're wonderful. I can't tell you how much I appreciate this. I'll try. I really appreciate this. Thank you very much.
Well, okay, that'll pass.
Yeah, cool. To everyone who is listening, thank you so much, as always, for joining us. You are the people who keep this channel alive. You are wonderful. We will talk to you soon, and have a great week. Make sure that you live long and prosper, and we will talk to you soon. Thanks.
Trek well, everybody.